want to welcome Marcina Tillman-Dick. She's the Chief Operating Officer for the Global Blockchain Business Council. They're based out of D.C., but they're a Swiss-based company. She's going to talk a little bit about the organization. Fascinating organization. If you haven't had a chance, please check out their website. They have wonderful material about blockchain. You know, blockchain is a pretty abstract topic, and we all think of probably blockchain in different ways. You know, for us in aerospace and defense, you know, blockchain's pretty significant. You think of millions of parts coming together to build a Boeing or an Airbus airplane, and we're all contributing to that. So I almost think of blockchain as a shared ledger in how we work together, but blockchain means so many different things in so many different industries. We think about cryptocurrencies. We think about how we secure funds. We were just talking about the music industry. So blockchain really intersects so many different industries. So a little bit about, you know, GBCC. It was actually conceived on Sir Richard Branson's island, I guess. I'm going to ask you later. Have you ever been there?
To have a meeting.
So if you ever been to Necker Island, that's probably a wonderful place. I know the Obamas were there recently, a couple years ago. It looks like a fascinating place. And I follow Sir Richard Branson on LinkedIn, and he's always providing some photographs from that island. So it's probably a great place for inspiration. But, you know, the organization brings together a lot of leading experts, innovators, business people. They're really focused on, obviously, cultivating knowledge about blockchain, but also the regulatory piece. You think about governments intersecting it, and currencies, and IP, and things that are really important to us in our industry. So we're really excited to have a leading expert, Marcina, in this organization. She is the Chief Operating Officer, and she's advised state and federal governments, leading Fortune 100 companies. I was just talking about her. You know, how does she keep her schedule straight? She's traveling around the world doing stuff. So we're excited to have her. So let's give her a round of applause and welcome Marcina.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here to talk about blockchain, some of this growth that the industry has experienced over the last few years, and why it's a relevant part of this conversation for all of you today. As was kind of mentioned, blockchain is really a back-end infrastructure technology. So it's unusual for a technology of this nature to have garnered such public interest. It's best known, as was mentioned, as the technology powering cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, but its use cases extend far beyond that. And while most people don't need to really understand the intricacies of how it works, I'm going to walk through some of the basics, because I would feel very bad if you left today and felt like you didn't understand it at all. So fundamentally, I think it's important to understand that the code behind blockchain technology is open source, meaning anyone can access it, and any technologist can build their own blockchain. So there's no one blockchain. Rather, there are many different blockchains. And they act as digital ledgers, permanent records of transactions. And in this record of transactions, every entry is grouped into a block of data. Once the data is verified or confirmed, that block of data is linked to every previous block, creating a chain and secured with cryptography. This makes the ledgers highly resistant to modification or tampering. And another real innovation of blockchain that I don't know is discussed enough is this idea of digital scarcity. So if I have a dollar bill in my hand and I want to give it to you, it's very clear that those assets have changed hands. But if we want to transact digitally, it becomes much more complicated. Because when we move anything digitally, whether it's an email or some digital asset, it's copied many, many times in the process. For example, if I send you an email, you're not actually getting the original email. You're getting a copy of that email, and the email has been copied many times in the process of getting from me to you. And while that may be okay when we're talking about email, it's really not okay when we're talking about money. And we take many different steps to mitigate challenges when transacting digitally. Usually we rely on intermediaries like banks or platforms like PayPal or Venmo, who have very expensive processes of verifying that I am who I say I am, that the recipient is who they say they are, that I actually hold the assets that I'm claiming to own, and that the transaction has actually taken place and those assets have indeed changed hands. So with blockchain, we finally have a tool to prove that something exists digitally in one place, and that we can transfer it from one owner to the next without duplicating it in the process. Of course, this has implications for money, but it also has implications when we think of any other vital document. We all still have passports that are paper-based. We have not yet found a mechanism for digitizing something as personal and precious as identity, but blockchain enables us to do this. And we're already seeing it done in a lot of different places around the world, notably Switzerland, Estonia, and other European countries. So for this and other reasons, blockchain is said to create an environment of trust. Publications like The Economist have deemed the technology the trust machine, because you don't need any existing trust to know that the activities that have been set into motion have actually taken place. You don't need to rely necessarily on these intermediaries. So the first blockchain application, Bitcoin, emerged in 2008 during the height of the economic crisis. At that time, traditional structures which enable individuals to store and move value were failing across the board. And this was a response to a general erosion of trust. As the historian Yuval Harari has observed, at its core, the Chronicle of Human Progress is a story of trust and cooperation. Before societies can solve any major problem, individuals have to trust each other. They have to agree on a basic framework of facts. Facts surrounding things like identity, property ownership, and the validity of transactions. And governments and financial institutions have historically acted as custodians of this information that makes up the base layer of our shared reality. We give up certain control as individuals, pay fees and taxes for these third-party entities to act as validators. Resilient and trusted institutions play an absolutely critical role in every advanced society's ability to function. And as the World Economic Forum's Global Competitive Report noted, if you want to predict the prosperity of a country, just look at its institutions. But unfortunately, trust in institutions globally is eroding. Worldwide, 85% of people say their institutions are not working for them. Trust in government is at an all-time low, and this erosion is seen across every sector and all geographies. The 2018 Edelman Trust Barometer, which does a very focused review of individual attitudes about trust in various institutions, revealed the largest ever drop in trust across all four key industries: business, government, NGOs, and media. And this collapse of confidence leads to a climate of fear that really undermines the bedrock of shared understanding that supports traditional structures and collaboration in every part of society. Blockchain technology presents possible solutions to pieces of this problem. I think you've already heard a little bit about the organization that I work with, so I won't spend too much time on it, but I will say that we really focus on three key pillars. We're in over 50 countries, so we're very, very global, which is necessary with a borderless technology like blockchain. But we're primarily focused on maximizing the benefits of this technology for industry and society through education, advocacy, and partnership. We work very hard to educate stakeholders, think legislators, regulators, business leaders like yourselves, both broadly about the technology and then more specifically as it can address internal frictions that they're facing. We advocate for rational, informed regulation that comes from a place of understanding as opposed to being solely reactionary. And we hope to encourage adequate consumer protections without inhibiting innovation. And then finally, and this is kind of a natural consequence of all of the other work that we do, we curate forums which foster partnerships of all types. And through this work, we get a really fascinating global perspective on the industry and on how different jurisdictions are relating to it. So over the last years, we've seen discussions about blockchain evolve pretty dramatically. I've been in this space just since 2016, but it's been around since 2008, and truly, at its inception, conversations were reserved for coders in basements. But they are now being highlighted in some of the most important forums on Earth. Just in the last year, we were invited to the spring meetings at the World Bank and the IMF in Washington, D.C., the G20 summit in Osaka, World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Switzerland. These are very significant forums which are making this technology a fundamental piece of their programs because they recognize that it's going to be a critical element of the solutions that we build moving forward. And last year, with the announcement of Libra, we saw conversations surrounding specific regulation in this space move very quickly. In frontier markets, we're seeing huge enthusiasm for solutions this tech can facilitate. Just as mobile phones enabled some countries to skip over copper wires when providing telephone access a generation ago, blockchain-based solutions are helping societies now leapfrog legacy platforms that are failing to deliver results today. And in more mature markets, you have folks like the EU setting up their own blockchain observatories and forums, official entities dedicated solely to studying this technology. The U.S. Congress has a blockchain caucus that we work with very closely, and we recently hosted a forum with them and many of our members where members of Congress came and listened to folks from Salesforce and Fidelity and Accenture and others who are building solutions demo their projects as well as a number of different startup companies. And, you know, these are all really good things for the industry. I think it represents progress, but it's also important to bring it back to what this actually means for all of you. So before we engage seriously with governments or corporates and get into any nitty-gritty details about actually implementing blockchain-based solutions, we work to address a few key questions. And these questions were conceived of in collaboration with a group out of MIT called the Digital Currency Initiative, headed by Neha Darula, who is a brilliant asset to this space. I think these are just helpful to establish whether you should be considering this technology for the frictions that you're working to address. They're relatively straightforward, but they do help to provide some clarity. You know, what's wrong with the existing solutions? Who or what is maintaining the status quo? How will this technology address that? Why doesn't any other existing technology do this effectively? What's the deployment strategy, and what change ultimately would we be asking of users of this system? As I mentioned at the outset of my presentation, the most obvious application for the technology is in the financial services space. And it's not just cryptocurrency, but truly like cross-border payments and payments generally. By removing costly intermediaries, the complexity and expense associated with financial transactions can be dramatically reduced. This application has potential to open the economy to billions of unbanked individuals, and especially in places where existing banking systems don't function very effectively, it could be a game changer. So if you think of a Kenyan doctor living in Los Angeles who wants to send money home, the fees associated with that transaction can very normally be between 17 and 20%. That's really dramatic when you think that you and I can move money for free. Through blockchain technology, those transaction fees have been reduced to sometimes as low as 3%, which is pretty great. And that can make a world of difference for an actual individual, but we're also seeing very large institutions. We have a financial services working group based out of London with folks like Wells Fargo, the London Stock Exchange, Moscow Stock Exchange, Japan Stock Exchange, and others, who are all looking at this for cross-border payments because the existing rails, even in advanced organizations, aren't actually very effective. The Australian Stock Exchange is actually totally revamping their technology framework and deploying blockchain as the solution there. So we will move on from financial services, because even though we all have to worry about money, that's not really the topic of conversation today. And I'll speak briefly to the idea of property rights. Because when we think of kind of digital scarcity and verifying that somebody owns a piece of property or an asset digitally, I think this is a big deal. And throughout history, the implementation of formalized property rights has led to increased economic prosperity, security, societal resilience, and environmental protection. But this just statistic kind of blows my mind every time I think about it, but of the more than 7 billion people on Earth, only 2 billion have titles proving ownership over their assets. This is really problematic for many reasons. Ownership, when it's not recorded, can't be used as collateral to get credit, which really stultifies economic mobility, and you begin to understand why certain economies are able to function at a much more advanced level than others. And this so-called dead capital, these assets which aren't tied to legal documents proving their owners and existence, are valued at $10 trillion globally. So an example of how blockchain can be used to address this. The Republic of Georgia in 2016 was ranked as having the third most accurate property registry globally. I think this is an important point because when you think about using blockchain technology, the solution is really only as good as the data that you feed into it. So it was important that the data in Georgia had already been revamped by the World Bank and recognized as being fairly accurate, third globally, which for a place like the Republic of Georgia is pretty great. But the process was unwieldy, and especially with the threat of political aggression from their neighbors, they really wanted to create a decentralized system which was digitized and which would enable folks to register their property quickly and would allow them to access those rights regardless of any political turmoil or natural disaster. This is a real threat when you think of Haiti, for example. During the 2010 earthquake, the building that housed all of their vital records was completely destroyed, and they did not have redundant systems. So digitizing these types of things and creating more decentralized systems is something to consider, for sure. After integrating a blockchain-based land registry, the data became secured, decentralized, real-time, and retroactive auditing was possible, and the frictions and costs associated with registering the piece of property were reduced from a few hundred dollars to truly a fraction of a cent, and it went from taking a couple of weeks and folks leaving their information and then needing to wait for the actual right to arrive to taking a couple of minutes, and people leave now the property registry office with a unique key that allows them to access their title regardless of where they are or their situation. So obviously the friction and opacity of contemporary governance makes it a pretty ideal theater to deploy blockchain-based solutions. And one country in particular has become a real leader in doing just that. It's kind of an unlikely leader, but the country of Estonia, which is not a big country, it has 1.3 million residents, but they boast the most advanced e-governance system globally. Everyone has a digital identity that exists alongside an analog identity, and they're able to use that digital identity to engage in virtually all of the transactions and processes that we all spend time pursuing on a daily basis. E-residents have access to a range of digital services, banking, prescriptions, health records. They're all accessible via their smartphone, which means that in Estonia, the idea that you would actually have to go to a DMV to pick up a driver's license is kind of laughable because they've made this agreement. They share their information with the government once. There's a record of any time. It's accessed by any government official, and there's a very healthy legal framework surrounding this. So folks in the government aren't allowed to just go in and pull your data without a clear record of that activity happening. But estimates are that Estonians save hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes of time by virtue of having these systems in place, these fully integrated platforms. And the beauty of blockchain is that Estonia's systems are not only used by government, they can be used by all sorts of other actors who are kind of verified and validated to exchange information on those platforms. So when we look at aerospace and potential applications in the aerospace industry, I think we can distill it into, and defense, a few different categories. So we think about people, identity management, which we've just discussed a little bit, but we think about how individual customers, employees, suppliers, and partners manage their personal information. Tokenization, how can things like loyalty miles be used as digital money? Bundled services management, how can we improve the customer experience by mitigating issues like overbooking? Then we look at supply chains and logistics. And to me, this is probably the ripest area for innovation in terms of blockchain. It just seems like a very obvious place to implement the technology. But you look back at identity, but in this case, also credentials management. When you think of a pilot or someone who's supposed to have certain credentials to operate the machinery or to do whatever they're doing, how do we identify and verify those credentials? Usually it's a pretty convoluted analog system, and there are lots of rooms for there's a lot of room for failure. We also think of real-time track and trace, reducing counterfeits, fraud mitigation, and increased transparency. Data analytics, improving information sharing for regulatory. This is a big deal. I think regulators are increasingly interested in the idea of more integrated platforms where you can instantaneously share information to streamline reporting processes. And then aircraft leasing and insurance. How could we create more streamlined information sharing or self-executing smart contract agreements, which function as long as certain conditions are met, the contracts execute themselves. Then we look at safety, security, flight record system security, data sharing and analytics. How can we enable faster info flow across agencies and stakeholders? I'm increasingly impressed by just how siloed so much of the information that different industries use is. And how can we create more controlled mechanisms for sharing that in a responsible way? And then again, insurance and financing. How can we integrate digital financial services to improve risk analysis, reduce fraudulent claims, and actually remove sometimes very unnecessary middlemen who take a huge piece of the pie? So the attributes of blockchains that make them especially relevant for challenges related to public data sharing and established processes are, I think, establishing trust when individuals or entities may otherwise lack confidence in data accuracy, maintaining quality when threats of tampering or adjustments to information may affect data reliability, and facilitating transparency when individual actors lack trust in a central entity or repository, or when transparency is needed for other accountability purposes. So the Department of Defense has one of the most complicated supply chain networks globally. They have thousands of partners, and right now there is no single source of truth for supply chain data among DoD organizations and their partners. Most entities manage their own records. This fragmentation of data leads to a significant amount of error in tracking, and in this environment, it's really hard to optimize. So when you think of trying to reduce costs or shorten times of delivery or manage inventory, it just becomes much more complicated when all of this information is siloed. So defense organizations have pretty limited visibility into data, which makes it hard to track goods end to end and leads to confusion, miscommunication, and often results in folks receiving incorrect parts or incorrect amounts, finding that shipments have been lost or misdelivered. The opacity of the data causes a lack of trust between vendors, carriers, shippers, and other supply chain partners, which can lead to a significant shortfall or oversupply of goods. And it means that determining the amount and availability of resources needed becomes an uphill battle. Blockchain backend solutions can enable goods moving through supply chains to be scanned at each step. I think it's important to underline that blockchain is usually used in concert with many other technologies. So it's not necessarily a replacement to everything that's currently being used, but it's an additional layer. And it can allow the manufacturer, shippers, carriers, and other intermediaries updating the supply chain to share their information instantaneously. This gives folks visibility into data that's needed to accurately track and trace goods and identify problems, again, in real time. And whenever a supply chain partner adds a record to a blockchain platform, it digitally signs the data using a private key. So there's a clear record of who is doing all of this information, and there's a real sense of accountability for maintaining all of this information. Once the data is added, it can't be tampered with. So, as I mentioned a little bit, blockchain really works well with other emerging technologies. Think Internet of Things or IoT. For example, a shipping container could be fitted with IoT sensors that automatically update the blockchain with information about the container's contents. So it could include data such as temperature and humidity, which really could improve the quality of our supply chains pretty dramatically. Unlike the public nature of the Bitcoin blockchain, where anyone can participate, supply chain blockchains can be built very specifically to be accessible only to a group of trusted supply chain partners. Sensitive details such as geographic information, the type of good, the origin and destination can be further encrypted and made visible to an even more limited subset of trusted participants. So the Department of Defense has actually been using blockchain for a couple of things for several years. They have a few projects. Some are more public than others. Many of them do relate to supply chain management. They recognize this as a really valuable tool in 2016. And you have other departments who are using it, including the Department of Treasury, which is using it to track mobile devices, to better manage resources and eliminate underutilized technology. The Army is also using it to pursue medical device tracking. You have the Department of Health and Human Services using it for a project they've been more public about that will save the agency time and money by providing greater access to secure, standardized data. And I think there are clearly kind of analogs across any industry that's dealing with supply chain. You know, as long as you're dealing with a number of disparate actors who need access to a solitary source of shared digital truth, this is something that you should probably be considering. And so because many of the applications in the supply chain space as related to aerospace and defense are not entirely public, I'm just going to spend a moment speaking about some of the similar applications where entities have been much more public in the food safety space. So food safety is a really big problem globally, but definitely in the United States. The numbers associated with this in the U.S., 28 million people fall ill every year as a result of foodborne illness, and approximately 3,000 die. So this is a big, big issue. And Walmart recognized this as a challenge in 2016, partnered with IBM, and decided to develop software to track and trace products much more specifically. It all started when an executive from Walmart charged with, food safety, I think he was the vice president of food safety, went into a store, grabbed some mangoes from the shelf, and asked his team to figure out where the mangoes had come from and where they had been every step of the way. And it took a team of 30 people, 6 days, 18 hours, and 26 minutes to successfully track those mangoes. After integrating a blockchain-based solution, that process took a mere 2.2 seconds. And it wasn't just about identifying which farm those mangoes had come from, but they were able to identify which tree those mangoes had come from, which means that if forever there's any reason to pull mangoes, contaminated mangoes from the market, they can do a much more targeted pull of those products. There's not as much waste associated with it, and both from the perspective of Walmart and their suppliers, they're protected financially much more. Another issue that we've seen related to food safety is the authenticity of products. So there's an Australian-based company, Latitude 28, which is using it to tackle the problem of products that are being sold as Australian beef in China that are actually counterfeit. This is a huge issue in China. It's estimated as being a $2 billion business annually, counterfeit beef, who knew? And it's not just a problem because it's decreasing the ability of Australian farmers' ability to sell their product at a competitive rate for them, but it's also a question of, again, food safety, because you have things like rat meat being packaged and sold as Australian beef. And at one point it got so bad that in Australia they recognized that 500 times the amount of beef that is actually produced in Australia was being sold as Australian beef in China. So, big, big challenge. This company, Latitude 28, has developed an app which is very consumer-facing that allows you to actually just scan the product and determine whether it is, in fact, a legitimate product or whether it's been counterfeited. So, I realize we don't have a lot of time, so I'll just wrap up quickly and leave a lot of room for questions by saying that especially when we consider the challenge of cybersecurity, I think a lot of these solutions are increasingly important. When we look at existing data storage solutions, they're usually stored in like one data center, which means that if you can attack that one data center, you have access to the data and you can disrupt it, you can cause a lot of turmoil. But if you use more distributed networks, it's kind of analogous to the idea of, you know, if you try to break into one house, you go, you get into the one establishment, you do your damage. But if you have a distributed network, you're required to simultaneously break into thousands of geographically distributed homes at the same time. And you're just much more protected because the data is linked and distributed. So I think it's helpful to just assume that these more distributed models are going to be more resilient as we move forward. There's an excellent book, and I've included some additional reading at the end of this presentation if folks are interested. But there's an excellent book that was written actually long before blockchain was ever conceived of, called The Starfish and the Spider, about the difference between centralized and decentralized models. And, you know, at the crux of it, they talk about if you have a spider and you cut off its head, the spider will die. But if you have a starfish and you cut off any appendage, it grows back, and it grows back stronger. And this can be seen across different societies when you think about Cortez invading South America. He had a lot of success until he attacked the Apache Indians, who had a much more decentralized structure of leadership. And so if their leader was cut out, they just had others who immediately replaced that, and they were actually able to gain ground in an incredibly impressive way. So I think that's a helpful model as we consider some of these possibilities. And as many of these use cases suggest, blockchain will likely redefine and replace many of the underlying systems which make up the fabric of our everyday lives. And as with any new technology, there's no guarantee that the impact will be evenly distributed or universally positive. And realistically, it will probably take a generational effort to deploy these solutions. But I'm excited as I see so many different corporates and governments embracing a new generation of open innovation powered by this technology. I think it will enable us to reinvent systems that are deeply embedded, things like governance. And by creating an immutable source of shared truth, the technology is really creating a new generation of solutions that are specifically built to create trust between actors. And when we look at our kind of global landscape, politically and otherwise, at a time when trust in every kind of institution is eroding, I think these more integrated models have never been more critical. So I'm really excited to see how they develop over the coming years, and I'm happy to take any questions that you all may have. Yes.
Christina, how has the healthcare industry overall looked at this, like with patient records and global society? You're traveling, you get sick, and then another hospital knows nothing about you.
It's an excellent question. In the United States, the healthcare industry has been slow to adopt the technology because it's such a heavily regulated space, but there are other models. In Estonia, for example, they do have digitized medical records, which means if you get hurt, you get into an ambulance, and you're able to identify yourself, they can immediately pull your records before you even get to the hospital to provide a better kind of consistency of care. And there's always going to be a record, again, of the folks who are accessing that data. So there are still protections in place for personal privacy. But you also see it in the United States with folks like Johnson & Johnson and others who are using it to track pharmaceutical supply chains, because there, again, are lots of challenges related to counterfeits. Especially when we think of substances that are heavily controlled, like opioids, they want to have a clearer record of where these products have been every step of the way, who has access to them. So there are a number of initiatives. They're just, in the United States, I think, in their very nascent stages. And when we think of medical records, generally, I think they're is benefit in terms of like interoperability, or as you said, moving from one care provider to another in terms of digitizing these things. But blockchain isn't actually a very effective tool in terms of combing through a huge amount of data. So in terms of proving that a patient is who they say they are and some kind of key points, that's great. But if you want something that is really effective at getting through a lot of heavy data, you're going to need to integrate it with another type of technology. Yes?
I'm a salesman, and my kind of model is know, like, trust. They know me, they like me, they trust me, we're in the business. I imagine trust is basically the only thing you've got to overcome, because the potentials of the success making this all easy and easy to see and easy to read, and the Mango story, you know, it's instantaneous. I now know where all this has been. How are companies who have blockchain saying, hey, you can trust us? Because I mean, that's the only thing that would, I'm worried you're going to have me and someone's going to take me and duplicate me. And I'm, you know, Austin Watts will cease to exist if somebody else digitally duplicates me and I'm not there. I don't know how that trust is being assured.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and any emerging technology is going to have these different hurdles, right? Initially, you have to kind of convince the stakeholders that it's worth considering and adopting. Then you have to build the solution, and then you have to figure out how you interface with the consumer to make them feel. I think of the romaine lettuce scare, for example. I still know people in my own family who say, oh, I don't think we should buy romaine lettuce. And that's months after all of those issues have supposedly been addressed. But even if Walmart, for example, now Walmart has all of its leafy green suppliers use a blockchain backend because they've had so many challenges related to leafy greens and food safety. But if the consumer doesn't know and trust that technology, people still may not buy romaine lettuce. And honestly, I think that's the next hurdle for the technology, is coming up with mechanisms to let the average consumer trust that this technology really is a tool that they can have confidence in. I think a good example is the Bitcoin blockchain, which has existed for over a decade. And while different exchanges have been hacked, you've probably heard about lots of Bitcoin being stolen, the actual technology has never been hacked. And there is a huge prize for anyone who would be able to hack the Bitcoin blockchain. No one has been able to. So I think the technology is really resilient. There are, of course, going to be different intermediaries who are introduced in order to make it more user-friendly, and you always have to ensure that they have very resilient security measures. But I think it's an excellent point, and I think it's really an existing hurdle for the industry. Yes?
Maybe to simplify or clarify, in the supply chain, let's use as an example the aerospace industry, wouldn't blockchain really be related in each specific block or supplier? And then it's just kind of like, yeah, we can get the answer faster, but it's not going to be like Bitcoin. It's not going to be in 2 seconds. It'll be the way I can go to ITT, and they're going to know everything that happened via their Internet of Things, their sensor pickup, their supply chain ERP system data. But I'm going to be here at the Navy, and I'm going to say, okay, I got a problem with this engine, so I'm going to call supply chain, and then they're all going to come through. So I think we don't want to confuse that there's going to be this, like Bitcoin, database or 2 second answer. And in our world, it's going to be more, let's look at the Internet of Things, let's look at RFID tagging, let's look at our supply chain for what they know. We have regulations, for instance, of knowing if the global supply chain is having people be slaves, right? We're not allowed to employ them. That's a regulation we have to meet. So in so doing, knowing that who is in our supply chain, we can identify that we have a bad guy in there. When a bad guy gets the focus.
Yeah, I think that's a really good and important point, and it will depend on the industry that you're working with.
Right.
So another example that I didn't mention but was part of the presentation is Coca-Cola. They're also trying to keep forced labor out of their supply chains. They are the only company to operate in every country on Earth, save North Korea. So they have incredibly convoluted supply chains with all sorts of different actors, and they don't want this issue. And I mean, it's a regulatory concern, but I think it's also an ethical concern, and you have more and more companies realizing that their consumers are paying attention. They don't want products that are produced by slave labor, and so they are using blockchain to create a secure contract registry for all of their workers. And it really takes, I think, some of these major actors, whether it's the Department of Defense or Walmart or Coca-Cola, who create their own blockchains and then validate you as a participant in their blockchain. How you use information on a company-wide level will depend on how many external actors you're interfacing with, right? So if you mostly are just working within your own organization, maybe a database is adequate. But if you are consistently needing to share very critical, sensitive data with external sources, then blockchain may be a really good thing to pursue. Yes?
So one of the interests that we have as an A&D in blockchain is in the supply chain, say, making an aircraft. And that data gets moved through electronic means from Boeing or Northrop or whatever down through the whole chain, and the concern of a bad actor getting in there and mucking around with that stuff and as a way of damaging or hacking or screwing around with the aircraft or even stealing the data. The issue I have is most of, when you get down to the bottom of the supply chain, there's a la and ma and pa machine shops. and they don't know the word blockchain. So my question is, but that's where it's headed, because that's the vulnerable spot. Boeing is well protected. It gets, I don't know, 30,000 challenges a day, but it's got all kinds of actors, professionals, that are protecting it. Not so down in the shops that are less than 50 people. And they've also going to get hit with CMMC, mm-hmm. all this other stuff. So the question I have is, when blockchain that gets started at Boeing and works its way down, and they'll eventually require everybody, what's it look like from the mom and pop? How difficult it is for them to participate in this? It's incredibly difficult from a cybersecurity point of view. They got to hire an expert. They got to get CMTC involved. They got to, all this kind of stuff to protect their thing. What's the complexity to at the end to the bottom supplier, the ones that's? Is my question clear?
Yes.
What's the degree of complexity to them?
And I think the best way for me to answer this is, again, through the analog of Walmart with its leafy green suppliers, because we're talking about farmers all over the United States who don't have very sophisticated technical infrastructure. And a lot of the cost and complexity of implementing a blockchain solution is increased when you attempt to scale it. But if you're building something that's relatively small, the cost and complexity is actually not terrible. I don't think it would be helpful for me to throw out specific numbers, but I do think that it's important to recognize that with Walmart, they now have all of their farmers operating on a blockchain platform that they have built, and then they have provided enough information for these individual suppliers to integrate their activity with the blockchain. But it's not as though all of those platforms need their own blockchain, or all of those suppliers need their own blockchain. It's Walmart's platform, and the suppliers contribute to it as validated and verified actors.
You said something significant. You said small versus large. So whatever Boeing's going to do with a aircraft, or Northrop's going to do, especially with defense stuff, is unlikely to be small.
And it's going to be very expensive for them, yes.
Yeah, but what does it look like for the people at the bottom? Because you're going to have a huge supply chain, but at the bottom is going to be this machine shop. What's it look like to them to get to participate in what inevitably has to be a large blockchain system?
So Boeing is going to build a platform, ostensibly, that will facilitate participation from individual suppliers. And individual suppliers will need to meet certain requirements in terms of data integrity, but I don't think that they necessarily have to build out significant technical infrastructure as suppliers, because they will be participants in this larger platform that's already been established.
Is it going to look like software as a service? Is that the
hardware or software?
Software.
And is it on computers?
It's distributed. So it depends on the architecture of the actual blockchain. You have some blockchains which have maybe 5 distributed nodes who participate. You have others who are truly going to have thousands of distributed nodes. They're each
node.
Like a computer, basically, a data center. Usually. I mean, you'd need to have a significant amount of computing power to engage, usually. But there will be different applications which facilitate participation from a phone, potentially, through an application.
So, like, one of these small guys has a computer and internet access.
Mm-hmm.
They basically can get blockchain.
Yeah, they can participate.
Because I don't understand it, I mean, is that like downloading software and just clicking on some hyperlink in an email that your buddy sent you? It just sort of doesn't make sense because I've not seen it.
Of course. And I think we have some videos that will be going up, or maybe they're going up this week. We were recently at the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, and we had a bunch of different presentations where folks actually demoed the solution, so you can actually see, like, the user interface, what it looks like.
Yeah.
Basically, it looks like any software portal that you're used to, but it requires certain logins and there are certain levels of encryption that secure it at a different level than what we're used to at this point.
Sort of a follow-on to that, maybe the leafy vegetables and greens is easier, but so that farmer is going into a portal onto the blockchain built by Walmart or potentially by Boeing or Northrop, then does Ralph's have a different one? And are they, if they're supplying multiple, you know, the small machine shop that is working into multiple supply chains, do they have to juggle that, or does it come together in some way?
This is a huge question and challenge for the industry, is interoperability, and whether we are creating coherent standards which will enable all of these different platforms to work together consistently in a secure and effective way. There are several really thoughtful organizations working on this, but it is, many think, premature to establish those standards because the technology is evolving so quickly and the capabilities are changing pretty dramatically, even by the month. And so those conversations are being had, but we don't yet have a comprehensive set of standards which would mandate that these different platforms are fully interoperable.
I think just to expand on that, I think, you know, with Boeing, you know, there's a supplier portal. So companies like ITT Engage, today we use it more for deliveries, purchase orders. I think the future is truly a shared ledger all the way down to the source of the material, because we're heavily regulated. We have CFCs and you know, certifications required for the origin of our products. And that's where they want to go. I think this is where it gets challenging, right? Because we have IP. We want to still operate our businesses. We don't want the Boeings or the Coca-Colas of the world controlling how we make buy decisions and our labor. But you can kind of see where that's going. And I think additives will certainly add another dimension to this. Because really, when we talk about additive, we're sending encrypted data to a printer and we're printing up a part, because that will be the machine shops of the future, right, Ivan? I mean, I think those CNC machines will go away in the next 50 years, and that will be a fascinating environment. You think about commercialization of space, you think about, you know, just the encryption piece of that. And I guess my question for you, Racina, is, you know, what do you see in the next 10 years as the major hurdles to really adoption? Because, yes, we do supply to the Boeings and the Northrops. Yes, we will have to engage more so than ever before. 5G will help us on our mobile devices that we're just starting to realize. But I guess, what do you see as the major hurdles in the next, let's say, 10 years for further adoption?
There are many hurdles, but I would say most of them are not actually technical.
Yeah.
I think the technical infrastructure is evolving very quickly and will meet the demands. But the challenges, the perennial challenges, are related to building up these collaborative consortiums. And we've seen, which is fascinating to me, this new model of what folks call co-opetition, where you have traditional competitors working together on solutions. You see it in the energy industry with oil companies who are working to create shared ledgers because they recognize that they need it in order to remain competitive and to continue to function. But creating those effective models of governance and collaboration is really complicated. And in terms of actually seeing kind of solutions that the consumer can enjoy, I think the biggest challenge will be really solving this question of digital identity and how we can establish a shared standard for digital identity, because once you solve that, you have so many different possibilities opened up to you. But really being able to prove that someone is who they say they are digitally, to protect that information, to allow the person, for example, when you're pulled over for a speeding ticket, you want the officer to know your name and that you're a licensed driver, but maybe not your address, and maybe not that you're an organ donor, or any number of things. And so how we can create these models for digital identity and then build on top of that. So those are kind of the big challenges.
And scary at the same time.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Christina, has anybody published any information around how quickly a blockchain system pays for itself?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there are, it's a bit complicated because so many of the existing solutions have been in pilot form.
Okay.
And so we don't necessarily have data yet. Okay. There are projections. You definitely have a lot of interesting papers projecting the value. But I don't know that any solution is really advanced enough and, you know, to a scale that would be interesting to you to prove that it was cost effective.
In the commercial side, two big players are Airbus and Boeing. Mm-hmm. And then on the defense side, you've got a whole bunch of players. Do you have a sense of what the status is of the use of blockchain in these two areas? They're probably different, but let's just take Boeing and Airbus. They certainly talked about protecting this whole digital communication to their supply chain. Do you have any idea what their status is in the use of blockchain?
It's a great question, and well, we may be aware of certain conversations that have taken place. They're not public about that right now. It's interesting to see which entities are very public about their embrace of this technology and which are working on it behind the scenes and have no interest in disclosing that to outside actors. And it makes sense. I mean, a lot of the solutions are, as I said, in pilot stage, still in test mode. They don't really want to let folks know they're working on it unless they know it actually works. But even Walmart, which has been viewed as kind of an early adopter, it's really hard to get information from them. You have to sit down with their executives and really tease it out. They don't publish it very publicly. Well, just because it's not a priority for them. They don't see the value in publishing this because consumers, as to your point, consumers don't understand it. And so it's this kind of very niche world of folks who would be interested that they're adopting it, and it's not, they don't see a valuable return on investment in making a big splash about that. Coca-Cola, for example, when they announced their secure contract registry, received an incredible onslaught of feedback, requests for comment, and they went totally silent. And we've worked with them, but they don't want to talk about most of the work that they're doing publicly because it's not their brand, it's not their priority, it's a back-end infrastructure technology, and they don't really see a need to broadcast that to the general public.
Would you see Boeing and Airbus, though, that this is inevitable, that they're going to adopt something like this?
I think so, and especially as they hope to engage with, you know, the Department of Defense as they're integrating it across the board, I think it's absolutely essential. Yes?
I just wanted to share with the group. So we have companies that TTC has worked with that are blockchain, supply chain things, really cool products. So RFID tags, mostly starts in food, medical chemicals. Some of the reasons it gets top secret is because really Walmart doesn't want you to know if they have some refrigerators that didn't hold temperature. So there's all kinds of hardware, software, IoT things that have to make this work right. So you have to have, when you walk into or out of your refrigerators at a Walmart now, in theory, they have to get the doors that have the sensors, and it has to read the RFID tag on the product end or on the pallet. And some of the RFID tags were wonky in the last 5 years. It's a real interesting technology. Simplifying it backwards to this conversation, it's about the software. So what happens at the supply chain level? Each guy who's a player in the market, and there's a handful that are kind of big, medical devices big too, they do it like for, you know, I have a hip replacement, it's all in one of those supply chain things. It's just software. So they hand the software to the guy, and the guy puts it in his computer, and let's hope he knows to be cyber secure, but he's not going to be because he's in food right now, or what the medical guy might be. And they just type in that, you know, here's the MSC information, right, our material information, and they're just typing it in the way you type in stuff to make a shipper, and then it's uploading. But it's in theory securely uploading. But that's why it's simple in food, and not really that simple once it gets into the retail end of it all, and simple in some of those industries. But for us, there needs to be the standardization. Remember when we had the tools on the floor and we had to worry about sex, gem communication with all the ERP systems, how to pick it up? Okay, they don't have any of that figured out. So that's where the standardization comes in. So there's a couple big players with software. If you have one software, then it's like whoever said to. It's kind of like back in the day with ISOs and Ford and GM, they had to have their own versions. And all the little guys were uploading into five things until they figure it out. So it's a road. But it's really cool. And it really works for, like, Bitcoin. And maybe is E-Verify, like, an example of kind of a blockchain? Because we have to pick up data about people. I don't know.
You know, it's not a blockchain, but I think some of the attributes are similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're not really touching it. I think it's really about SAP tries to have flavors of it, right? Some of the bigger ERP systems. But in our world, I hope to live to see the day.
It will be many years yet, I think, until this is actually integrated across industries in a way where the average consumer can really see the clear benefits.
But I do think that some of the cybersecurity initiatives that we have going on, where we think it's all about, you know, they tell us, oh, it's because of these foreign governments or whatever. Sure, that's true. But it's also the strategic vision of firm yourself up, because we want more than just EDI information.
And I think that's the key, is awareness, right?
Yeah.
Especially for smaller companies in our geographic region. I mean, you can see where this comes together, right? I think for us in aerospace, you know, the FAA and EASA are our regulatory on the commercial, Department of Defense on the military. It seems like those folks really need to embrace some standards. Otherwise, we're going to be playing the Northrop game, the Airbus, the Boeing, and it'll be very expensive. But I think we're all motivated by counterfeiting.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of examples. I sit on a national committee in D.C. where there's counterfeiting of 3D printed parts.
Okay.
And the origin of that material could be very consequential to our respective businesses, especially if there's a safety event, right? We're flying at 50,000 feet. We expect our product to work. There's heavy regulatory. So it seems to me that the FAA and EASA really need to get together on this with national industries to really embrace how some of these standards could really be deployed, because I think there's some key things. And then I think getting back to you, Jim, on ROI, I mean, scrap, origin of material, you hear things about the REACH Act, all of the compliance stuff that I live and breathe every day, that comes down, and they change. If the EU changes some paint that you can't use, we have to verify, right? The soldering material that you use on your PCBAs, whatever they are, you can see where blockchain makes a lot of sense for us in industry. So obviously, it needs to be embraced. Standardization seems like is a big challenge. Big companies see the value in, you know, tracing mangoes or lettuce, but I think there's certainly some value for all of us here, all the way down to the material, especially once we get into additive. You think about the powder. Where did that titanium or aluminum powder come from? And then the counterfeiting, the IP aspect of it.
The formulations of those materials are all specific, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, great. Well, any other questions? I know we're running short on time, but thank you. I want to thank you for sharing.